welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Alex Krotowski, and I continue to jaunt around the United States. This week, I'm in San Francisco for the Game Developers Conference. But don't get excited, there'll be more from this show next week when Bobby Johnson, Keith Stewart, and I cover all the announcements from the show floor. Now, although we'll be swimming in the pool of computer games next week, this week we're dipping our toes into the puddle of DIY game development with Boyd Malter from Microsoft, general manager for Microsoft's XNA group. We're also speaking with Rory Kellen-Jones, the BBC's technology correspondent, who gives us a personalized backwards glance over the challenges and the changes he's experienced in covering the tech scene in the decade he's been on the beat. Finally, we're welcoming Glenn Shoesmith from BookingBug.com into the lift for their elevator pitch. All this plus the latest news and some choice feedback from the past couple of weeks over the next 30 packed minutes here on Tech Weekly. DIY gaming was a hot topic at last week's South by Southwest Interactive Conference, and one of the main players ushering this trend into the mainstream was the big kahuna, Microsoft. While at the show, I caught up with Boyd Malter, general manager of XNA, the community that offers Xbox game development by the masses, for the masses, to find out what the service has in store. I began by asking him what was new.
When the community game system launched in the fall, we got a lot of games coming through. I think a lot of them are 2D, which is kind of what I'm still hoping to get a bit more 3D. And yet there's a lot of innovation going on in there. And I'm very excited to see some of the crazy titles that are coming through. And we are starting to see that whole experimenting and testing thing that's happening through the system. What we haven't seen yet, but will, is that a lot of the really good titles that have been built through it are going to end up going to the Xbox Live Arcade system. And that takes a longer time, so we haven't seen how that plays out yet. But those titles are happening, and we feel very good about those.
Well, that's kind of the money shot, isn't it? That's really where that's where people start thinking, "Ooh, fame and fortune, I'm going to be picked up by Microsoft, and I'm going to be the next, I'm going to be the next big designer."
Yeah, or other publishers as well. So Live Arcade has definitely got a heavier marketing aspect to it, but the community complements it by allowing lots of experiments and lots of different titles to happen.
So in this panel, you talked a lot about how it was easier to code or easier to use, but ultimately it's still quite a difficult language. Can you talk a little bit more about that and whether this is actually an opportunity for people, me, for example, to sit down and put a game together?
Yeah. So up until now, if you want to write a game, you're going to be learning C, and you're going to be coding shaders sometimes in assembly, going up into shader language, and it's hard. So we went to C Sharp, which is still programming. I'm not going to play that down. It's still programming, but it is much easier. And a lot of the grunt work, the repetitive grunt work you have to do to make a game look really good, we took all that away, so now you're focusing on building your game. The direction I hope to see this go to is that it continues to get easier to pull the code part together, and you're spending more of your time working on your story and your artwork and making it fun. Ultimately, that's what it's all about.
Does everybody have a good game idea in them, or do you think that there are some people out there who, whatever they did, even if they had the world's easiest tools, that what would come out would be just terrible?
It's just like the film industry. Everyone thinks they have a good idea for a movie, and it turns out that not everybody does. But there's lots of experiments, and if you can put it out there, we'll see what resonates with an audience and what doesn't. And you just look at the independent film festivals, and you can see there's a high production quality, even though they're keeping their costs down, and lots of innovative ideas, and some will rise up higher than the others, and that's totally expected.
Who has risen up thus far?
There's a game called The Dishwasher. James Silva wrote it, a complete one-man shop. He did all of it. That game is really, really awesome. I don't know exactly when it's coming out. I think it's getting close to getting through the Xbox Live Arcade system, written in C# from the beginning. That's a great example of a game that's fun to play. It's got a good look. It's got good music. It's got a good style to it. One guy did it. It's really exemplary.
Now, there has been, of course, criticism about the system because people have said that there are far too many terms and conditions. There still is a gatekeeper. This isn't an indie system as open as, say, the PCs. Just put your computer game out there on the web and anybody can play it. There are still gatekeepers. And I'm wondering, first, can you comment on the idea of being a gatekeeper and what it is that goes through the system, that you allow through the system?
So with Xbox Live Arcade, it absolutely is a managed business. Right, and they do want to have a small number of really good titles so that the audience comes up, and they know they're getting something that's going to be polished and thought through all the way. On the community arcade side, we actually went to great lengths to minimize the amount of gatekeeping that we did. The only real gate that's in there is that you can't put a pornographic game in. Otherwise, it's up to the community to go and look at the games and decide if they are done enough and that they don't have the prohibited content. And Microsoft people are explicitly not looking to see what can and cannot come through. Actually, I'm really happy with this aspect of it because it puts us in a spot where the community games channel is actually more open and has less gatekeeping than the other systems that are in place.
Why has Microsoft decided to do this? Traditionally a closed platform, arguably. Why has Microsoft decided to open up game development to the community?
We've decided to open up game development for a number of reasons, and they a lot have to do with forward-looking trends in the industry. We are really at a point where we are moving more towards artistic values, artistic production quality, and good stories is the primary driver over how great is the shader. So those are still super important, and on the 360, they feel like they're about equal, right? But it's all about telling stories now, and that's going to be true going forward. At the same time, we have to lower the cost of telling those stories and getting them out there, and that means more people can do it. And it's easy to look at at what's going on with the film side and the internet to know that there is a huge market for independent games and for independent thinking, right? The big professionals who have so much money at stake on games are very risk-averse. Now, sequels can actually be really good, right, and having good franchises can be a lot of fun and get some really great games that way. But there's lots of room left in the system for innovation and for experimentation. And even the publishers are looking for ways to tell what's going to be the next big smash hit and lower their risk. So it's good for everybody. It's good for us because we get lots of titles. It's good for the publishers because they can see what's going to work or not without having to risk $100 million. And it's good for the independents who can tell their story and have more ability to get a message out there. It's good for the ecosystem.
If I was to develop a game, say, how long would you say it would take me?
That depends entirely on your game. I'm not kidding. If you want to make a puzzle game, right, and the graphic format is relatively simple and it's all about your mechanic, you can get one of those going very quickly. If you want to make a big, in-depth first-person shooter with lots of levels, it's going to take a very long time. But we've had a variety of games in the game studio system that have come up within a day or two, and they've got playable levels and playable demos. And there's also other ones that take years to flush out. So it really depends on the amount of artwork that you're making and the complexity of the story you want to tell.
That was Boyd Malter from Microsoft. Now here's Jemima, one of Twitter's top 1,000 players, with the latest news.
BT has announced the rollout of super-fast 60 megabit per second broadband at 29 exchanges. Trials begin this summer, but the system should cover 40% of UK homes and businesses by 2012. Telefonica and Vodafone have confirmed that they will share infrastructure in several European countries, including the UK, in an attempt to cut costs. The two firms, which account for hundreds of millions of mobile customers globally, said the deal was necessary to benefit their shareholders. The Open Rights Group has urged the UK's seven biggest websites, including Google, Yahoo and Facebook, not to use Form, the controversial ad targeting technology. ORG claims that under UK law, the firm needs explicit consent to use data in this way, but Form insists most web firms are already employing similar technology. Amazon's flagship gizmo, the Kindle, is facing a patent suit over its e-book technology. Discovery Communications accuse Amazon of infringing a 2007 security feature patented by its founder John Hendricks in 2007.
You can read up on all these stories on guardian.co.uk/technology. Keep your eyes peeled all week for the latest, or grab the Twitter feed, Guardian Tech. More information is available at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Rory Kellan-Jones has been the BBC's technology correspondent for over a decade. And while he's been tracking everything, he's also been consuming the cutting-edge devices that he covers. Our fearless producer, Ben Green, spoke with Rory at The Guardian's Changing Media Summit last week and began by asking him how his patch has changed in the last 10 years.
Well, it's changed out of all recognition. I really first got interested in it from a business point of view in the late 1990s, when all these companies were springing up that were suddenly worth billions without ever having made a profit. And I've very much got into covering the whole dot-com scene. That went pop, and my brief period as the BBC's internet correspondent ended when that went pop, and I went away quietly, maintained an interest in technology. The interesting thing was that during that great long technology downturn that followed the dot-com bubble, things did keep changing. All these great new companies were born. Really, Google came of age, really, after the dot-com bubble burst. We had companies like Skype born. The whole mobile revolution really started taking off. So there was suddenly an awful lot more to cover. And so a couple of years ago, the BBC said, do you want to be technology correspondent again? And I leapt at it.
Now, can you imagine that the landscape will change again as exponentially as it has in the next 5 or 10 years? I mean, can this rate of change keep going?
I'm sure it can, but the most foolish thing I or anybody who writes about or broadcasts about technology could do would be to predict it. I've just been watching a film made by the post office in the 1970s predicting what life would be like in the 1990s, and it was completely risible. We all know about those predictions about how many computers there will be in use and how wrong they all turned out to be. So the change will go on. It'll probably accelerate. I'm even being told by various businesses that during the downturn, innovation actually accelerates. There's even more pressure to come up with something new. So I'm hoping that that will be true.
I was wondering if we could just get a little personal for a moment. I've seen you've got lots of devices in your pockets and in your bag there. What are your essential things that you carry around with you all the time?
I carry far too much with me. I've got a laptop with me with a 3G dongle to get me online at any time. I've got, I think, 3 phones about my person at the moment. I've got an iPhone, although I've broken that. I've got a Nokia N95 because I was doing some dodgy mobile video experiment a while back and I'm still carrying that. I've got a BlackBerry to get my corporate email. Oh, and I've also got a mini video camera, a Flip Video, which enables me to snatch a quick bit of video. And somewhere in there, I ought to have an audio digital recorder with a microphone attached for my radio work. It's a bit frightening being what the BBC calls multi-platform these days.
Now, what about your Facebooking and your Twittering, Rory?
That has become a total obsession in perhaps a dangerous way. I think my family certainly thinks so. I did a piece a couple of years ago for the Today programme on, are you ever too old to Facebook? Was I too old for social networking? I thought I was, but unfortunately I got sucked in, first to Facebook and then to Twitter. And although it's incredibly fashionable and rather boring to deride this kind of stuff, now there seems to be a column every day in one paper or another saying, oh, Twitter's so trivial. I do think not just Twitter, but all of these social networks are incredibly powerful tools and are only going to grow in importance. They're bringing people together. They're being used to mobilize political campaigns. For me, I find them essential in actually doing my journalism. Last week, I set up 2 entire stories for BBC Television News via one of those social networks. I put some queries out on one of them and back came the answers.
This week in our elevator, we welcome Glenn Shoesmith from startup Bookingbug.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor.
Which floor would you like?
Services for SMEs.
Going up. First floor.
So, who are you and what's your company called?
Hi, I'm Glenn Shoesmith from bookingbug.com.
Okay, then. Explain your business to my mum in 2 sentences.
Okay, basically, Bookingbug is a sort of online booking and reservation system for services. So, for example, if she needed to find a wedding photographer for her beautiful daughter's wedding, for example, she might look online for all kinds of different wedding photographers. So what Bookingbug enables them to do is allows a wedding photographer to show their services online in multiple locations. And this works for any kind of service-based businesses, including rooms, classes, courses, events, day-based, time-based. So it could be a dance instructor, it could be the caterer, it could be a clown, a children's magician, anything it could be, any kind of services you need. You can find and book them online.
Second floor.
So how do you make money then?
Basically, so for any kind of small business, we allow them to manage their services through Bookingbug and then embed it in multiple locations. So we're not a destination site ourselves. But what we do is we charge the business a small amount for either making bookings or making payments. I mean, it's a free service to use. We also have a subscription model, but the idea is we just take a small cut of any payments and bookings. We also allow, if they embed an affiliate site, so if a dance instructor embeds in a dance website, we allow that dance website to also take a small cut of bookings and payments made. So it's kind of about sharing the revenue and sharing the wealth.
And so how many people use your website now, and how many do you want to use your website in a year?
Well, it's one of these things, isn't it? You can pick all kinds of random numbers. We've got about 70 sign-ups in the UK of businesses. We've got about sort of 20 or so in the US, so we have a UK and a US site. It's growing. We're getting like a sign-up every day, so that's great for us. Our target in 12 months completely depends on the affiliates we get signed up. I mean, we're speaking to some great companies that could bring us, you know, thousands of small businesses. And really, if we get those done, who knows? I dare to dream.
Third floor.
Okay, so who are you competing with?
Well, we have a whole range of competitors. I mean, in the US, people like Our Town are doing a sort of booking system that's sort of similar, but no one's really doing the sort of the affiliate plugin model that we're doing. There's lots of small ones in the UK, but they're generally tied to specific markets. They do ones for B&Bs, or they do ones for plumbers, or they do ones for dentists. We're kind of very generic. We do one for everything, and we plug into lots of different sites, and we'd like to think that no one's doing what we're doing at the moment.
What's your biggest challenge?
Getting yourself known, getting the affiliates signed up, really. I mean, people say, how are you going to find the small businesses? But we don't think we need to find the small businesses themselves, because, you know, if we get an affiliate that is a directory site that lists tennis coaches, we get every tennis coach, and that's great. It's finding those affiliates, getting those deals with those affiliates, persuading them that what we're doing is a great idea. But, I mean, really, it's all going well. So it's not so much challenges, it's just a question of getting it done and getting there.
What's the weirdest business experience you've had so far?
Oh, wow, that's a tough one. There's so many. It's really finding the unusual uses for Bookingbug we didn't think of. I mean, obviously, you know, when you say booking time, people come up with all kinds of sort of fairly cliched examples and stuff. But, you know, people are using it for all things. You know, it's like, oh, can we use it for this dating site? Can we use it for this, that, and the other? And it's finding the unusual experiences and uses of it we didn't think of, I think.
Fourth floor.
So do you think there's a new Web 2 bubble?
No. I don't like to think of it as a bubble. I think it's a more sustainable thing. It's definitely a slower growth, I think. So there's a lot of excitement. It's like the first dot-com bubble, I think, in a sense that people are excited. There's lots of good companies starting up. But I think there's a lot more realism about, you know, you must be profitable. You won't get investment for stupid ideas. You're not going to get millions and millions. I think it's a lot more practical, a lot more sustainable. So people overuse the word bubble. I'd like to think that we're on a sustainable growth, especially in the current market where other industries are perhaps in a downturn. So I'm excited. It's a good time to be in it.
Where do you think you want your company to be in 5 years' time?
That's a very open question. I mean, there's so many places we'd like to go, but I mean, obviously, we're never supposed to be the destination service, so we're always the hidden place behind that powers the bookings, that powers the search, that powers finding services, and other people are the destinations. You don't come to Bookingbug, but what we want to do is actually powering all those sites, helping all those directory sites, those listing sites, those, you know, we list dance teachers, we list campsites, we list wedding photographers, all of those, helping them, helping show people's availability online, and be the company that powers all of that behind it.
Are you the next big thing, do you think?
Of course.
Doors opening. Please mind the doors.
That was Glenn Shoesmith from Bookingbug. And if you've got a startup and want to be featured on Tech Weekly, let us know at tech@guardian.co.uk. We've had some great feedback over the past few weeks. Oliver Davis from the Netherlands was particularly impressed with Charles Arthur's prescient predictions for 2009 when he heard last week that IBM was to buy Sun. Over on our Facebook group, he commented, "I'm shocked, not by the story, but that Charles Arthur accurately predicted the demise of Sun during the first half of 2009 in your 2009 prediction show late last year. Well done." Well done, Charles. We've also heard from Daniel Pacey from Edinburgh, who sent in a picture of himself via our Twitter feed on Google Street View. And we want to see who else is listening to us. If you've been grabbed by the Street View car and are now online, do send it in. Add it to our Flickr group, Guardian Tech Weekly, or send it via mail. Well, that's it for this week on Tech Weekly from The Guardian, but we'll be back with more on the games front next week when Bobby Johnson and I will be joined by my Guardian Game Theory co-columnist Keith Stewart to dissect the biggest goings-on at the Game Developers Conference. I'm covering the show from the floor, so keep your eyes peeled to the games blog and to the tech blog for the latest. Until then, I'm Alex Kratosky. Our producer this week was Ben Green. See you next Tuesday.